Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Road to Recovery group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Wayne and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. In support of AA's singleness of purpose, we respectfully ask that sharing be confined to alcoholics and that when discussing our problems, we confine ourselves to those problems as they relate to alcoholism. There may be visitors here who are unfamiliar with our tradition of anonymity. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and television. This tradition is a constant reminder that personal ambition has no place in AA. We are sure that anonymity is the greatest safeguard AA can ever have. We therefore seek your cooperation in protecting the anonymity of our members at the public level. The format of tonight's meeting will be 3 10-minute speakers, followed by a fourth speaker until approximately 8:30. The meeting will then be open to the floor and closed at 9 o'clock. Anybody being disruptive or disrespectful of the meeting will have their video turned off and they will not be invited in to share. Each main speaker will have a 2-minute warning bell and a final stop bell. Please could we show our appreciation to each of them with a round of applause after the second bell. Can we please have a moment's silence to remember tradition 5? Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. It now gives me great pleasure to introduce our final speaker, Tom B. from Los Angeles.
Over Hi, to Tom Bouchard, alcoholic.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Wayne. Thanks for having me on here. I want to thank our sharers tonight, Christopher, Allison, and Mike. All different stories, but the same feelings, which is what we seem to relate to. If you're new here tonight, look for the similarities, not the differences. The stories were all different, but I can relate to everybody that shared tonight because we share a common disease. And I'm glad I know what's wrong with me today, that I suffer from a disease called alcoholism. And the thing is, I've got quite a bit of sobriety under my belt, but my disease is active and well between my ears. And that will be with me until the day I die. That part of my disease, that mental facet of my disease, is always out to get me. Like I was told early on, my head's like a bad neighborhood. Don't go into it alone. I have three things that have kept me in good stead for over 39 years now. And that is, I have a sponsor. I had a sponsor the fourth day I entered the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've had a sponsor ever since then. I have a sobriety date, which is February 10th, 1981. And I have a home group, which is the Pacific Group. I'm very grateful today that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't found it necessary or found any reason to leave it in over 39 years. I've been upset with things that have happened over the years, but never enough to leave the group or leave my sponsor. I've taken a lot of contrary action in my life. I will tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I grew up in a small northern New England town on the Canadian border. I used to hear from, let's put it this way. At around 4 years old, my mom used to put me in a harness and tie me to the railing. Basically, because she, I was in a hurry to go anywhere. And I think probably what they call today ADD, I had it. You know, she didn't know what to do with me. I used to hear things like, what the hell were you thinking, Tom? You know, I did things. If I thought it, I usually acted on it. And long before I ever took a drink, I was getting into trouble. So it had nothing to do with the alcohol. My ism, I believe, and that's my opinion, not AA's, that I was born with this disease. That the way I think is I don't think in the real world a lot of the times. I'll give you a quick example. I'll tell you a little bit more about the wife I'm married to today. We've been together for, I think, 47 years now through two marriages. And you leave me today. She's my best friend, you know, my lover. You know, she is the person that is closest to me in my life. But you leave me in a resentment for about a day and a half. And I will tell you, because that is the feeling that I have, and it is real to me, is I don't know why I'm in this relationship. It's never worked, and I'm out of here. And, you know, the thing is that has no basis in reality whatsoever. But that's where my head goes as an alcoholic with this disease. And like I said, it's alive and well today as it was when I walked through the doors, as it was when I was growing up. The other feelings that I can identify with that most alcoholics have is that self-worth problem. You know, I have nothing to blame it on. I wasn't abused as a kid. I had loving parents. I grew up in a loving family. I didn't need for much growing up at all. I was with the nuns in a parochial system for 8 years. And, you know, that's not the reason I'm alcoholic. You know, I heard things. I was an altar boy. Also, long before I ever took a drink, I was a liar, cheat, and a thief. I would take money out of the baskets. I would serve mass. I would serve mass in the mornings at the 6 o'clock mass. And at that time, I think this had to be like in the early 50s. Was given 25 cents a mass. That's what they paid us to do. And so it was $1.25 a week. And I guess I didn't feel like that was enough. So I would take an envelope out of the basket to take with me every so often. So, you know, if I'd have known what I found out at 17 years old, what alcohol would do for me, I'd have been taking the wine that was set out for the priest. But I didn't have a clue at that point. So I went on like feeling inadequate, not measuring up, wouldn't ask anybody out in high school unless I knew they'd say yes. Couldn't deal with rejection whatsoever. Came out of high school and I was introduced to liquor that summer. Beer just didn't do it for me. That was the first thing I had, but I couldn't get enough down. Maybe that should have told me something, but it didn't at the time. I couldn't get enough down to make any difference. But somebody gave me some gin mixed with, something sweet, got it down. And I was to find out that night what alcohol would do for me. It fixed everything on the inside. Totally. I felt equal to, if not better than, anybody I was hanging around. And I'd never had that feeling before. It was a feeling of ease and contentment that I was not going to let go of for the next 17 years of my life. It became, as I look back at my life, I sort of started to go downhill at that point. You know, I've always been, even in drinking, I've been a functioning alcoholic. But, I didn't go to classes my first year of college because my parents weren't overseeing me at that point. And, I found much better things to do, like hitchhiking. chance I got, because what it did for me was just phenomenal. My second year of college, my first year of college, I flunked out, which stands to reason. You don't go to class, you don't study, you flunk out. And this happened to be 1964, 65. There was a little thing called Vietnam going on. I don't think I was really aware of it. I was so self-centered and selfish that I don't think I really knew what was going on in the world. My mom did, and my dad did. And they, mom got me into a college the next year where she went to, where she grew up in a small town. And I remember her saying, I thought she, what she told me was, don't embarrass me, Tom. And I thought she said, don't flunk out. So I didn't flunk out that year, but I got kicked out because of my drinking and because I wasn't pulled in front of the dean, but I don't like to be told what to do. And I played basketball, and this coach at this small college wielded a lot of power. And I told him where he could stick his basketball team and his basketball. He didn't care for that. And I ended up with a letter to the draft board and to my parents that I wasn't welcome back the next year. So off I went. I, again, don't like being told what to do. So I went down and joined the Navy. Got to boot camp and realized I had made another drastic error in judgment. I now had 4 years to do instead of just two. And as I look back on my life, my higher power was working in my life unbeknownst to me. You know, I was making decisions based on my head. And, you know, at that time, everybody was into the Army, into the infantry, and into the jungle. And I ended up on a carrier 10 miles off the coast of Vietnam. And that's where I spent, you know, a good 12 months of my Navy career. But I definitely enhanced my drinking there. I left, I got out of the Navy. We separated, or we parted. I had an honorable discharge, but they didn't want me back, and I didn't want to be there to begin with. It seems like, as I look back, that was the longest 4 years of my life, but the drinking helped get me through those times. If I wouldn't have worked, I was a non-com rank, and I worked for officers only. So if I'd have had to answer to the chain of command, I'd have been definitely court-martialed and kicked out of the service. As it was, I managed to get out of there. And then I found this young lady that was younger than me. We were from the same hometown. She was 5 years younger, so I knew her brother, but I didn't really know her. And we ended up getting married, and I took her. I was also, I like to stay close to what I love to do, which was drink. So I ended up in the bar business, in the restaurant business, and I took her on a, I think we got married, and we got together in 72 and married in 73 and divorced in 1980. And I took her on a ride of I would get a resentment, didn't know what to do about that. So I'd leave, and then I'd hurt myself and come back, and she'd take me back. That relationship was just toxic. Excuse me. 1980, my father passed away rather suddenly, and I think I went into some type of depression at that point. And the restaurant wasn't making it for me. That used to be my playground, and I didn't know what was going on. I knew there was something wrong, but I couldn't figure it out. And I came up with this brilliant solution that if I divorced this wife, because she was my problem, quit this job and left town, that things would be different. And that's what I did. And in January of 81, I came to LA, and I came to Laguna Beach to look up a cousin. I wasn't with him for maybe 4 or 5 hours. I I realized right then and there that I felt the same way I did when I left Maine, and that scared the hell out of me. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I had no clue that drinking and using had anything to do with the way I was feeling. So I when I feel that way, I run, and I went up to LA, and like Christopher, I looked up an old bar manager of mine that couldn't stay on a bar stool on his day off. And he opened the door to his place. And I went there to party with him. And I saw his eye better than I've seen him in my life. I had to let him go back east because he just couldn't. He was a bad drinker. And I said, geez, Ray, you look great. He goes, yeah, I got a DUI, reduced to reckless driving, and I've been going to AA. I had no idea what AA was. To me, the alcoholic was the guy I kicked out of my bar or out of the restaurant because they were panhandling or doing something to that effect. And, I remember telling him, he says, I don't drink. He says, I haven't drank for over 90 days. And I thought, Jesus, he looks good. I said, I brought some good weed from back east. So, he said, no, you don't understand. I don't do anything that affects me from the neck up. And my first thought is, how the hell do you have any fun? But I hadn't been having fun for a long time. You know, a good 6-8 months was no fun. So I laid on his couch, and he took me to my first meeting. And he was a member of the Pacific Group and had a... I really didn't know what to expect. I walked into that meeting and you people scared the hell out of me. All I saw were teeth and hands coming at me. And, you know, people were giving me their number on a piece of paper and I'm going, what the hell's this? What do I do with this? I just wanted to be part of Ray's back. And, you know, what I found out later was I found my people that night. I really did. For some reason, you know, as I look back on it, Ray, you know, I thought, Jesus, if Ray can do this, it seems like people are happy here. They didn't look like the guy with the paper bag coming into the bar. I mean, they didn't look like alcoholics to me. And I thought, if Ray can do it, maybe I can. And I started going to meetings. On that Wednesday, I was taken up to this tall dude and said, you know, a couple of guys I had talked to in the meetings on Monday and Tuesday said, ask this guy to be your sponsor. He sponsors me. And I will tell newcomers that find somebody in the group you're in. First of all, find a group that you go to on a regular basis, and then find somebody in that group that is sober about the same amount of time as you, and hook up with them. I had two or three guys that were sponsored by the same man, and we did everything together. We checked up. When I wouldn't tell my sponsor something, I told my friend, and they pulled my covers, you know, and it's just it's a good way to go. When I was that Friday, I was like 6 days sober. On that Friday, I had an interview with a company called Charlie Brown's in Marina Del Rey. And because I, you know, like I said, I was a functioning alcoholic. I'd run restaurants. I had troubleshot restaurants. And I interviewed with this guy on a Friday. And he told me, he said, look, give us 6 months. You come into this restaurant as an assistant manager. In 6 months, if you like us and we like you, I'll give you your own store to run. I thought, great, I'll take it. And then I called the sponsor that I'd gotten on Wednesday to give him the good news. And his first things out of his mouth was, you can't take that job. You know, I know what kind of hours are involved and you won't be able to get to your meetings and you can't take that job. And I think I started to argue with him. And he hung up on me. By the time I went to that Friday night men's stag, and I don't know where this came from, but, you know, I knew he was right. I think, again, my higher power choosing to stay anonymous, let me know that, hey. So I went to the meeting that night and I said, Matt, I'll do anything you tell me. That was the first time in my life that I can remember ever doing something different than I wanted to do. I was willing to take a contrary action in my life. That was my first big surrender. You don't have any relations in the first year, and I understand that. Most of us come in here and we need to get our own lives in order. We got nothing to offer anybody else in a relationship, so that's why we say stay away from relationships in that first year. And I did that, and as it turned out, we got back together. We had two boys. And one of them didn't fall far from the tree. He's just like his dad, only he became an addict and took it way further than I would want him to, or that I did. And he spent a lot of his time in prison, and he wasn't brought up that way. But and the other guy just seems to know intuitively what to do about living, like one of the promises for us. But he does just fine. And, when I was about 12 years sober, I had a business and I had to close it down, and everything was going south. This was like 1992, and middle management wasn't available. I had put out 1,000 resumes, didn't get one interview. And, I talked one night and they said, well, you had the restaurant business and you've been in sales. Have you ever thought of the other side of the business? So I had an interview within a week with a company called Rykoff back then and a company called Cisco Food Services. And Rykoff wouldn't hire me because they figured I'd leave them after this whole, it was like a depressive time. And, Cisco gave me $500 a week, and that was gross. My nut was around $6,000 to $7,000 a month, so it didn't make any sense for me to take that job. But in my second year of sobriety, I went from my sponsor who left town, Matt, to Clancy, who was his sponsor. And Clancy told me, take the job, kid. And I thought, you crazy old coot, I'm going to lose the house, I'm going to lose everything. How can you tell me to take this job? Makes no sense to me. He said, just take the job. So again, this was another turning point in my life. I took the job and lost the house. 2 years later, we walked away from the house. I was just getting on my feet. But 19 years later, I left that company, retired from that company with a pension, and been retired since 2011. Go figure. I'd have never taken that job. My thought process said, no, you can't pay your bills. Why would you take a job like that? It's the willingness to do it somebody else's way that has worked out in my life. I ended up, I'm not good speaking like I'm doing right now, but I'm much better one-on-one with people. And so I ended up for some reason getting a lot of sponsees, and I drill down on them contrary action, because that is, I do more today. I'm aware of more than I do today that is contrary to what my head tells me to do, because my head will always tell me, you don't need to go to that meeting. You don't need to share this tonight. You don't need to do this. You don't need to do that. You've got a lot of time in program. When I used to drive to the Saturday night, because the same way everybody else did when I came in here, I was told 7 meetings a week, 7 commitments. And I, up until this Zoom stuff, from the time I was probably 13 years sober, I've always had 3 steady meetings a week that I go to, that I am committed at. Wednesday being one of them, the main meeting that Christopher talked about. And I try and be of service on a daily basis. My life today is, you know, you hear it all the time from the audience of AA, that it's beyond my wildest dreams. You know, there's no way that I could have the peace and comfort that I have on the inside today if it weren't for AA. Everything, absolutely everything good in my life is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had two knee replacements, so I don't hit my knees in the morning, but I always say my morning prayers and have for over 39 years, which is basically, I turn my will and my life over to my higher power in the morning, and I leave the rest up to him. I'm going to show up. I'm going to go about my day, and I will leave it to show me where to be of service to God, because that is our primary purpose here. That's my primary purpose. And as a result, you know, those feelings of inadequacy, that feeling of not measuring up, of not being enough, I don't have those feelings today. You know, I'm very comfortable with who I am. And, you know, I couldn't say that, you know, that's why I say I'm so grateful that I have the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because for the first 17 years of my life, before I found a drink, I did not have comfort on the inside. And the 17 years when alcohol worked, it fixed that. But then it didn't. And this way of life gives me slowly what alcohol did quickly, a quiet mind, peaceful stomach, and a way to go today. These Zoom meetings are great. You had John L. on here last week. I'll tell you a little story about Mr. Lichty. When he came in, he was a Golden Gloves champ, but he couldn't talk. I mean, this guy was so screwed up. And I had a kitchen commitment at Ohio Street, which is a meeting place that we have. And I had the kitchen commitment after, and John would stand in the middle of the kitchen. He couldn't move. And he says this sometime. I went up to him. I said, John, you know, if you're not going to do anything, get the hell out of the kitchen. And little did I know, he was a Golden Gloves champ. He could have decked me right there. For 30-some-odd years, and you know, we have a lot of people like that. Christopher, I've seen him around meetings, and you know, he would come to the Friday night men's stag, and I'm glad to see him today, and I hope to see him a lot when we get back to meetings again. Listen, again, Wayne, I thank you for allowing me to come on here and share my experience, strength, and hope, and I wish everybody a safe and sound life. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom. That was great. Thank you very much. Before